listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio, found online at kpfa.org. I'm Sasha Lilly. While we rightly associate the Black Panther Party with explicitly revolutionary politics and militant self-defense against police brutality, many of us are not aware of the extensive work that they did to confront neglect and mistreatment of African Americans by the medical establishment and the state. In response to a long and appalling history of medical abuse by Black people, the Panthers set up free clinics wherever they had chapters, screened community members for sickle cell anemia and high blood pressure, tested children for lead, and attempted to protect the poor and incarcerated from being the subjects of medical experiments. It was pioneering work, if now widely unknown, or perhaps forgotten, and it remains relevant 40 years later when stark disparities in health and medical care continue along racial lines. The publication of Alondra Nelson's book, Body and Soul, The Black Panther Party and the Fight Against Medical Discrimination, gives us a full accounting of this work by the Panthers, situating them within the history of African-American medical activism. It's published by the University of Minnesota Press. Alondra Nelson is Associate Professor of Sociology at Columbia University and is co-editor of Technicolor, Race, Technology, and Everyday Life. I'm very pleased to be joined by her on the phone from New York. Alondra, I wonder if you could set the stage for looking at the Black Panther Party's medical activism by reminding us of the dimensions of the history of racial discrimination by the medical establishment in this country against African Americans.
Sure, yes. It was like the history of racial discrimination more generally. And, you know, what I call medical discrimination or racial discrimination in medicine and healthcare has been sort of multi-leveled. So you've had Jim Crow exclusion historically in the medical profession. So you had Jim Crow teaching hospitals, Jim Crow nursing schools and medical schools and these sorts of things. You had, even when you had that small number of Black doctors you had trained, up until the late 1960s, African-American physicians weren't allowed to join local southern chapters of the American Medical Association, and thus they weren't allowed to join the larger national body, so they were effectively excluded from their professional body. And this also meant, so, you know, that's on a kind of structural level. Also on a structural level, you know, you had the federal government actually supporting separate but equal medical facilities. So it was the case that, you know, places like Grady Hospital in Atlanta literally had two towers that were identical, but one served Black patients and one served white patients, and these were constructed with federal monies. But of course, the care that was available to people was far from equitable in these two adjacent towers. And then, of course, there was the actual health care itself, to the extent that poor communities of color, poor Black communities could get access to health care and medical facilities. It was often atrocious, and so it ran the gamut from people just having their health care denied and completely just not receiving care. And these sorts of fears in Black communities sort of arise with stories around people like the medical researcher Charles Drew, who was said to have been, you know, was an advanced medical researcher from, I believe, Baltimore, but was left to die effectively in a southern hospital when he went down to go to a medical convention and had the misfortune of being in a car accident. And that's kind of an apocryphal story, as the historian Spencey Love has shown, but it's a story that, in its circulation and the fact that it's widely believed, by many people, suggests to us that people were, across the 20th century, African Americans distrusted the medical profession, distrusted hospitals, and moreover felt that hospitals were a place where you would be mistreated as opposed to healed. And then, of course, you have things that are more widely known, like the Tuskegee syphilis study. So it was the case that which would happen as the Black Panther Party were involved in their healthcare activism, in which the case, you know, which was the case where people beginning in 1932, close to 400 Black men sharecroppers were left untreated for syphilis. And so, you know, and there's also the the Henrietta Lacks story that some of your listeners might know about, which is about a woman whose cells were taken for medical research in 1951 in Baltimore at the John Hopkins Medical Center, or hospital as it would have been called at the time. And this was in the context of black people in Baltimore being quite literally afraid of Johns Hopkins Hospital, about quite and having all sorts of both true and, again, apocryphal stories about what happened if you were a black person and you ended up in Johns Hopkins, right? So the Henrietta Lacks story has to be understood in that broader context, too. And so over the course, certainly of the 20th century, but one could go back to the sort of heyday of scientific racism, and one could go back to the sort of era of plantation slavery in the U.S., you know, healthcare has never been it hasn't been much in the same way that, you know, young African Americans today don't look at the police for as being, you know, people that help them. You know, healthcare has not historically been a site of health and healing for African American communities for all sorts of reasons.
Well, we'll, of course, spend much of this hour talking about the Black Panther Party's health activism, but the history of organization around health issues by the black community did not just start in the 1960s, in the late 1960s. So tell us about some of that history, the people who prefigure in some ways the work that the Black Panther Party later did.
Yes, it's a really rich history, and I only am able to really sort of, you know, touch on a few aspects of it in my work, but I think it's a history that really needs to be brought to the fore, in part because it matters for how, you know, empowered people feel about their healthcare today. But some of the people that I write about are figures that are well known, but figures that we don't think about as being health activists. And part of what I'm trying to say is if we look a little deeper, the work that these people were doing were health activists. So I write about a physician named Daniel Hell Williams, who was a Chicago physician who would found Provident Hospital in Chicago, which was a very important hospital for African Americans in particular, and also did the work of serving as a nursing school for African American nurses. Because as I had mentioned previously, African American women were often excluded from the nursing profession and from nursing from training and nursing. And, you know, Hell Williams is often known as being a figure who would do one of the very first open heart surgeries in the United States. But he's important as someone who, you know, looked around and effectively said, you know, we don't have basic health care and certainly not modern health care facilities in our community. And I'm going to sort of create this. And it was a wonderful effort that would be continued, and a movement that gets called the Black Hospital Movement that happens around, you know, the progressive era, the 1920s, the 1930s, in which you have local communities, you know, often led by, you know, local doctors and nurses, but often working with churches and with local community groups who are doing things like making sheets for beds and sanitizing implements and these sorts of things. You had real whole community grassroots efforts of people, you know, basically saying, the only way that we're going to get adequate health care, unfortunately, is if we provide it ourselves, and who were doing these efforts. So that's one example. Another example is Marcus Garvey, who, you know, and if we, you know, typically how we might sort of link Marcus Garvey and the Black Panther movement might be to talk about how they both come out of a tradition of perhaps, you know, black nationalist thought or black freedom movements that had a kind of self-determinist, self-determination kind of lineage that they would continue, they shared that lineage. But one of the other ways in which they're connected is that I think unappreciated is the fact that health activism was a significant part of the Garvey movement as well. So the UNIA movement had a cadre of nurses called the Black Cross Nurses. And in the course of doing some other research unrelated to this project, I actually met 2 years ago Marcus Garvey's son, who's still living. He's he's a retired cardiac surgeon who lives on Long Island in New York City. And he told me that there's still a chapter roster of the Black Cross nurses operating in Belize today. So that's a little bit of a tangent, but one of some of the more memorable images we have of the Garvey movement, which are often these Vanderzee photographs, are images of Garvey, of course, and his sort of lieutenants and wearing these kind of ornate military costumes, and also Black women dressed in white nursing costumes, also sort of parading down these Harlem avenues as well. And these Black Cross nurses were interesting for lots of ways. I mean, they were named the Black Cross nurses explicitly as a critique of the Red Cross of the Red Cross nurses at this time. Black women were volunteering to join the Red Cross as nurses, but they were because of racial discrimination excluded from joining. And so again, like the Black hospital movement, you have the Garvey movement saying, "Well, we're going to start our own nursing corps." And of course, these nurses were meant to care for not only the local Black communities in which the UNIA chapters were located, but also, and more speculatively, meant to care for the kind of nation state in waiting that Garvey was creating, were he to be successful with his Black Star Lines and taking, people of African descent in the Americas back to Africa. And so that's another example. But even figures like, Booker T. Washington, who would start, National Negro Health Week, which would become National Negro Health Month, is an important figure. He was very much invested in issues of health care. And throughout this, you have both men and women. Certainly I wouldn't call the Garvey movement necessarily a feminist movement, although UC Berkeley, Eula Taylor, talks about the role of his wife and having a kind of communitarian womanist work, but you definitely had, like you'd have in the Black Panther movement, both men and women working side by side to create a kind of healthcare structure where one didn't exist, or where one existed that was not necessarily beneficial to Black communities.
The program is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio, found online at kpfa.org. I'm Sasha Lilly, and I'm talking with Alondra Nelson, author of Body and Soul, The Black Panther Party and the Fight Against Medical Discrimination. So the tradition that you were just talking about of medical activism within the African-American community continues very much so within the civil rights movement, which we tend to locate in the 1950s and 60s. Can you tell us about the work that activists did then?
Sure, yes. That was one of the more fascinating journeys in doing the research about this book. I mean, part of what the civil rights movement, the question it begs for us, I think, implicitly, is that, what happened to all of these people? So, we have all of these photographic images and this horrific film footage of people being effectively brutalized, by Bull Connor and other sort of white supremacist police authorities in the South. One thing I think we don't give enough thought to is sort of what happened to these people. So if it's the case that hospitals and the medical profession were completely racially segregated in the South, we can't imagine that Black and white activists from the North were being seen, and if they were being seen, being treated well by Southern doctors who come out of a kind of, a white supremacist tradition of healthcare provision. And so what civil rights activists would do was effectively to create their own core of health activists, and these would be medical students and doctors and medical students and nursing students, as well as doctors and nurses, and some people who just had training as medics and just, had some basic skills and who wanted to be a part of the civil rights struggle. And so there would be lots of people who did this work, but most notably was an organization called the Medical Committee for Human Rights. And they're often described as the medical arm of the civil rights movement. And they would be the ones who would tend to activists. And they would also go to places like the Mississippi Delta and small, poor Black communities and see that it wasn't only the activists who needed health care, and it was really the local communities that needed health care. And so out of actually the civil rights struggle for desegregation would come, the creation of some hospitals and healthcare services in local communities. Particularly, Alvin Poussant Wood, who was part of this Medical Committee for Human Rights and who's now a distinguished professor at Harvard, would stay down in the Mississippi Delta and work to help to establish a clinic there. And, you know, like, as we know, with the narrative of these sort of summer campaigns and these various campaigns in the South, many of these people would come back and they would be radicalized to do work. So we know that, for example, Sarah Evans writes about in part about the feminist movement of the late 60s and early 70s coming out of the experiences of the civil rights movement, for example. So such would be the case with health activism. So you'd have health activists who would literally go from working in the Jim Crow South to working in their local communities. So people like Jack Geiger, people like Quentin Young, for example, who would work with Mark Clark and Fred Hampton to start the Black Panther Clinic in Chicago. So you had literally a connection. And although we often, I think people who understand the history of the Black freedom struggle don't do this, but I think in the more sort of public consciousness about the civil rights movement of the 50s and 60s, and then the turn to the Black Power movement, you know, we spent a lot of rhetorical effort in trying to make these things quite distinctive. And I think one of the things one of the advantages that's offered to us by looking at the health activism is that you can see that these movements continue. So you quite literally have people coming out of Freedom Summer and helping to establish, for example, Black Panther health clinics. And so that these movements are contiguous, and that we should be a little suspicious of the ideological work that's trying to tell, you know, a sort of good civil rights, bad civil rights narrative about what happens in the late 1960s.
Indeed. Well, the Black Panther Party was founded in Oakland in 1966, and to understand the activism that they engaged with around health, one really needs to take a look at the context in which all of this work emerged, which was the Great Society reforms and war on poverty reforms of Lyndon Johnson, the establishment of Medicare and Medicaid in 1965, and then following that, the kind of backlash against those policies that was initiated by Nixon framed around a fiscal health crisis.
Yeah.
What was that fiscal health crisis? How was it understood at the time? How was it framed?
Right. Well, you know, the framing will sound very familiar to your listeners. It was much the same framing that we're getting today. And this is what's so interesting to me about this moment. And, you know, perhaps as we get further in our conversation, we might want to talk about the Affordable Care Act and these sorts of things. But it was a very similar conversation. So there were lots of people talking about this crisis, and the Nixon version, or the backlash, precisely as you say, was, you know, this sort of, you know, it was all of this sort of hue and cry about scarcity. So we don't have resources. Expenses are running amok. We can't possibly provide health care for people. Let's try to channel, to the extent that we can, health care into private insurance, you know, that the state can't help out and shouldn't help out. And, you know, certainly after the passage of Medicare and Medicaid, the backlash was, and you see it even today, right? This is why there's so much ideological struggle over the Affordable Care Act. It's like that politicians on the right really understood this to be a kind of ideological tipping point for them, and they really wanted to really sort of hold the dam against, you know, the creation or the expansion of the Great Society programs. And so the language around the crisis coming from the Nixon backlash was really about you know, the fiscal nature of it, that we just couldn't afford it, and that, you know, it was just, they were just ballooning and skyrocketing costs, and if people are sick, it's just too bad. Although, in retrospect, some of the things that Nixon probably would have allowed look fairly progressive today, given how to the right our conversation around issues of the social good and the common good, like healthcare have gone.
So at the time, those pushing back against the framing of a fiscal health crisis, or those actually involved in the debate, there were sort of two groups. One group was the liberals around Edward Kennedy, who were supported by various unions and health activists of different stripes. And then there were the radical health activists.
Right.
Tell us about the two perspectives that they brought, and the sort of larger argument that the latter group, the radical health activists, were making about medicine and society.
Oh, yes. And it's important to draw this distinction. Yes, there was definitely a stark difference between what liberals, like Democratic politicians, were advocating and what the activists were advocating. In part because, you know, the activists effectively were saying that, you know, it's great that we have these great society programs and war on poverty programs, part of which included, the formation of federally funded community health clinics, but these don't go nearly far enough, in part because they don't allow for community participation. It's really just these sort of bureaucratic structures that are meant to, you know, that are placed in local communities but don't allow for the participation of communities. So that was sort of one of the radical critiques. And of course, the larger radical critique, I want to sort of always celebrate these moments of success. So the reason that, you know, a term like medical industrial complex has come into popular parlance, I mean, people use that term all the time now and we know what it means, is because of the success of radical health activists and drawing attention to this, right? So they were in a moment 40 years ago or so where they were really beating the drum about this kind of perfect storm, you know, the bedfellows that were being created between pharmaceutical companies, insurance companies, and the sort of increasingly privatized healthcare sector. And they were saying, you know, health is not a commodity. It's a social good. Healthcare, access to healthcare is a right. We shouldn't leave, you know, people's very bodies, their very healthcare open to the vagaries of the market. And we see and we identify that this sort of collision of capital and commodification in healthcare is happening, and you know we protest, and you know, and they also, and these were people like Barbara Ehrenreich, who worked with an organization called Health Pack, who were doing just kind of really intensive analysis about how hospitals were getting their funding, how doctors were getting their funding, the way in which the AMA was, the American Medical Association, was involved in the sort of commodification of healthcare and these sorts of things. So the radical health activists of this period understood healthcare to, you know, not be something that should be commodified and didn't, something that should be commodified, and that it, moreover, that it wasn't a commodity at all, that it was a social good, and that it was a right.
So how did the Black Panther Party, which was known for armed self-defense and militant rhetoric, and that tends to be the way they're remembered, how did they become in health activism and ultimately healthcare?
Yes. There's a couple of ways of talking about this. One is, I think, if we look back, if we hark back to the work of the Black Panther Party, there's a way in which they were always involved in community service work. So if you even look back at the 10-point platform, the founding document of the organization from October 1966, there are places in that document where they're basically talking about social service and social welfare issues. So they're saying that people need access to housing, that people need food, that people need clothing, and these sorts of things. But the attention to healthcare comes to be expanded over the next sort of 4 to 6 years for lots of reasons. Partly because it's precisely because of this rhetoric and this sort of the debates about the healthcare crisis that are going on. I mean, there's a sort of, you know, healthcare is everywhere, much like this moment. You know, so people everywhere, regardless of their ideological orientations, are talking about healthcare and getting involved in this conversation about there being a kind of healthcare crisis in the late 1960s and early 1970s. And so they were definitely part of that conversation. Secondly, I think much like, you know, the sort of, you know, modern, quote unquote, modern civil rights activists of the 50s and 60s, you know, they saw in their neighborhoods that people, quite frankly, didn't have health care. I mean, it became something that in the course of having chapters in local communities became just obvious and apparent. And health care, you know, as I describe in the book, becomes, you know, after, you know, as we're as a nation sort of celebrating the legislative victories that would lead to the passage of the Civil Rights Act and the Voting Rights Act, things like healthcare really come to the fore as being something that can't be, you know, that weren't included as part of this legislation, that these are basic fundamental human rights, right, that are not part of the civil rights kind of framework. And these are things that are left out of that framework, and that are, you know, that it becomes a place where inequalities really come to the fore all the more because of the advances that have been made, you know, kind of ironically. And so, So that's part of it as well. And then you also have, as I said, activists who had been involved in this kind of medical arm of the civil rights movement who go on to, you know, who come and collaborate with the Black Panther parties and creating their sort of health services. So there's all of this kind of foment and interest and, you know, I think kind of frustration happening all at once. And healthcare is a little bit of all of those kind of sentiments. And so by the time you get to 1970, the Black Panther Party is talking about creating a people's healthcare plan, and they're talking about creating healthcare services in local communities that grow out of the local needs that they saw in these communities. And by 1970, it's the case that Bobby Seale mandates that this is also a moment where the Black Panthers chapters are kind of spreading exponentially. So people are inspired and motivated and radicalized by the work of the party. And, you know, so you have young people all over the country and all over the world, in fact, saying, you know, we're Black Panthers too. And so at a certain point, the party headquarters has to say, well, you know, what are the elements that all Black Panther parties must have? What to call yourself a Black Panther party, you know, what things must you have? What things must you do? So, of course, people, chapters had to sell the newspaper. They had to have political education classes, and there was a kind of often a set list of things that people had to read. And by 1970, they had to have, famously, their free breakfast for children program. And at the same time, and little known, all chapters had to have people's free medical clinics, which were community-based, grassroots-run, and also party-run, locally-based health clinics.
And leading up to this time, to the launching of these health clinics, was a particularly intense time for the Black Panther Party, as you write in your book, Body and Soul, that in less than a two-year period, in 1968 and 69, at least 28 members of the Black Panther Party were killed by the police. Did that have a direct effect on a sense that they needed to be able to have medical care outside of established channels?
Yes, absolutely, absolutely. So, yes, it was the case that, you know, the fact that people were being murdered, were being killed, had lots of effects. And one of the effects was that, you know, people quite literally, as you suggest, Sasha, needed health care. But it also had, you know, it created a sort of a moment of pause, you know, in the party strategically. So, you know, it caused the party leadership to say, you know, what are we doing and what can we do as such that, you know, we're not, you know, putting ourselves in the crosshairs. I mean, you know, in the context of the counterintelligence program, in the context of extreme police repression, you know, we can't blame the victim. There's very little the party could do to not be, you know, to find themselves in situations where they were being harassed and often murdered by police authorities. But it was the case that they could sort of switch gears a little bit and think in different ways about what the work of the party was. This would lead to, you know, a famous split in the party about what its future direction should be between Bobby Seale, the co-founders Bobby Seale and Huey Newton, and others who were allied with them, and Eldridge Cleaver. And, you know, Cleaver at this time really wanted the party to be more of a kind of underground sort of guerrilla organization and less of a kind of community service organization. And there's kind of strong words, at least in the sort of written record, both in the archival record and in the memoirs that the members of the party themselves write, that happened between the sort of Newton and Seale faction and the Cleaver faction about, you know, whether or not doing, you know, expanding their community service efforts was revolutionary, whether or not it was good, whether or not it, you know, it led to social change and these sorts of things. And then you saw the toll that these murders were taking, these deaths were taking on the party, really embodied in the very names of their community service organizations, or initiatives rather. So it was often the case that clinics and breakfast programs and their various other community survival programs were quite literally named for people who died as members of the party. So in Chicago, the clinic is named for Mark Clark. in Berkeley. The clinic is initially named for Bobby Seale when it first opens, and then after George Jackson dies and is killed in prison, the clinic is renamed for George Jackson. So the name, the very names of the community programs really embodied the kind of shift in course that the party was taking, and really was a kind of painful acknowledgement of the human toll that their radical politics sometimes took.
You're listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio, found online at kpfa.org. I'm Sasha Lilly, and today we're looking at a lesser-known chapter in the history of the Black Panther Party, the work that the party did in fighting against medical bias and disseminating free health care to people in the Black community. I'm joined by Alondra Nelson, who's written a book about just this history. It's called Body and Soul, The Black Panther Party and the Fight Against Medical Discrimination. It's published by the University of Minnesota Press. She teaches sociology at Columbia University, where she holds an appointment at the Institute for Research on Women and Gender. So, Alondra, what did these clinics set up by the Black Panther Party, the People's Free Medical Clinics, actually do and provide?
Yes, the clinics were fascinating. I mean, they were really examples of from the ground up grassroots activism. So, as I said, by 1970, the party mandates that all chapters have to have clinics, but the party is not well resourced, and all of the resources from selling their newspapers and those sorts of activities are going to the headquarters. And so the party leaves up to the individual chapters to do the work of trying to figure out how to pull together a breakfast program and also how to pull together the clinics. And so these are when you see local communities, much like the Black Hospital Movement, much like Daniel Hell Williams, really pulling together, the resources that they have. So the clinics varied. I mean, some of them were very, very modest. Some of them barely get off the ground. So there was a clinic in Kansas City that, you know, according to FBI records and memoirs and things that I was able to dig up in the archive, was maybe, you know, barely functioning and only functioned for a few weeks or a few months. And that was the clinic that was started by Pete O'Neill. And then you have clinics like the one in Chicago that is one of the more success, you know, one of the success stories. So there's lots of newspaper documentation. There's lots of historical records about the Chicago clinic, which provided all sorts of services, so basic preventative care, immunizations, basic examinations if people were just, you know, sick baby services and these sorts of things. They had a pharmacy there. This was one of the clinics that was established in part with the help of members of the Medical Committee for Human Rights. And I should say that, you know, almost all of the Black Panther Party clinics, like much of the Black Panther Party work, these were interracial collaborations. Particularly when you're dealing with healthcare and a moment where Black health professionals had been systematically excluded from the professions, in the 1960s and 70s, less than 5% of all African American doctors and nurses were African American, according to the census records. And so, you know, you couldn't even if you wanted to, you couldn't pull together a kind of national network of health clinics only with Black doctors and nurses. But the clinics did all sorts of things. So they did healthcare screening. Some of them did door-to-door health surveys. This was at a time, I think it's up until 1974, it was the case that buildings that the paint often contained lead in it, and that lead paint could lead to neurological problems in children. So the Panthers often went to older housing stock in particular and were looking for children who might have had lead exposure and were trying to get help for them. They in some cases did basic gynecological services. They did, as I said, I've mentioned, immunization. So just all of the kind of basic things that one would, you know, go to a doctor, local community clinic for. And then if people had more pronounced healthcare needs, part of what this Medical Committee for Human Rights and this sort of network of doctors who were radicalized and who worked with the Panthers allowed was that the Panthers could refer, chapters could refer people who came into their clinics and needed additional care to clinics who, or to doctors who were working in hospitals who they knew would treat these people well. So they would say, you know, if you have to go to Cook County Hospital, make sure you go and see this doctor. You know, he's our, you know, we work in solidarity with him. He's going to treat you well. He knows that you're coming and these sorts of things. So they really advocated for people to get, you know, appropriate care to the extent that they could. And it was also the case, you know, going back to thinking about how radicals understood healthcare as opposed to kind of the, you know, liberal mainstream electoral politicians, you know, they understood healthcare to be about, you know, the, you know, one's full life. They had a very kind of fulsome and capacious idea of healthcare, and this included the Black Panther Party. And so healthcare for them was about people's full quality of life, you know, their full well-being. And so their clinics really bore this out in the way that they operated. So of course people could come into the clinic, for, you know, medication or, you know, if they had, you know, wounds or these sorts of things that needed to be tended to. But it was also the case that the clinics were intended to be places where people could get access if, you know, access to food if they were food insecure. They could get leads for jobs. They could get, in fact, also job training in the clinic. So the clinics were run with often community, you know, volunteer labor in addition to the sort of work of the rank and file members of the party, that people could get, you know, at people who would help them deal with a difficult landlord, for example, if the landlord wasn't turning on their heat or wasn't dealing with, you know, infestations of rodents or these sorts of things. And so they understood, health, and the clinics really embodied this to be about the sort of, you know, the full range of one's life.
One of the most interesting elements of this story, the story of the medical activism of the Black Panther Party, was their campaign around sickle cell anemia and how they organized to get genetic screening of the African American community to test for this illness, which is genetic, and how they did that given the pre-existing framework of racist genetics. Tell us about that. It's really fascinating.
Yes, this was one of the more surprising elements. I mean, this is effectively where the book begins. And but I start with just a few passing mentions. So in a lot of the Panther literature, you might see a kind of passing mention that, you know, we did sickle cell anemia testing and we had clinics. And the sickle cell anemia testing in particular piqued my interest because, you know, the 1970s was a time, I mean, you know, today you pick up the newspaper every day and there's some story about the gene for this or the gene for that, you know. In the 1970s, people weren't thinking about genetic disease. They weren't thinking about genetics. You know, we were still 30 or 40 years from decoding the genome. This was not a moment in which regular everyday folks knew about genetics. And so just the kind of courage and the kind of conviction and the, you know, the intellectual curiosity that it took for radical health activists to get involved in discourses and, you know, around sickle cell anemia and also quite literally in genetic screening for sickle cell anemia was just astonishing to me. So I was really glad to be able to tell this story in the book. And yes, it's the case, you know, the Panthers recognize very well that, that genetics have been one of these places in which, you know, what they called inferiority theory played out. So this, it was one of the sites in which, you know, theories were advanced and, and, you know, medical journals and these sorts of things about, you know, what were supposed to be, you know, biological distinctions between, say, Black people and white people, and distinctions that were supposed to, the distinctions that were understood to explain inequality, to explain oppression, to explain, you know, why there was a sort of racial gradient, one might say, to inequality in American society. And so genetics, and this goes back to the history of scientific racism. It goes back to, you know, sort of the great chain of being in the sort of sense that there are, you know, four or five races and that we can sort of stratify them in order, you know, in levels of inferiority and superiority. And regardless of what the scientific theory is, with, you know, Black people always being at the very bottom. And so, you know, the Black Panthers' work around sickle cell anemia really demonstrated an acute understanding of this history, but also, you know, a sense that, you know, that local communities could get involved with, you know, the prevention of genetic diseases, and that local communities could get involved in conversations about how genetic researchers were framing or trying to frame or trying to make claims about specious and spurious claims about racial difference. And so the sickle cell anemia campaign, you know, is interesting on lots of levels. So on a real practical level, they were dealing with the sort of neglect issue that we talked about earlier in our conversation. The fact that, you know, sickle cell anemia had been, it's known in the medical literature as the very first genetic disease. It's the first genetic disease that's ever identified. We have known about it since 1910. And then it goes on to be, in human genetics, up until, you know, fairly recently, one of the genetic diseases that's been most researched and most worked on. So famous researchers like the Nobel laureate chemist Linus Pauling worked on sickle cell anemia, for example. So we knew lots about sickle cell anemia, yet there was little, you know, there was a little research being done with regard in the healthcare sector about sickle cell anemia, and there was little concern. There was lots of concern for sickle cell anemia as a sort of molecular curiosity. There was significantly less concern for the black people and the black bodies that were suffering with the disease. And so the Black Panther Party, you know, raised the issue that there's been this historic neglect of this side of the equation, the actual people who are suffering with the disease. And, you know, they say we're going to do something about it. And part of what allows them to do something about it and to start their sickle cell anemia campaign is that there's a change in the technology. So there's a new test that's still used today called SickleDex that comes to be introduced. That's that the party purchases with monetary donations, and sometimes they have donated from medical supply companies, that allows them to do sort of large scale genetic screening programs in parks and auditoriums, and also in the clinics when people that's one of the things, one of the services that people could get in the clinic. But of course, you know, like the clinics themselves, the sickle cell anemia campaign was not only about sickle cell anemia. So in addition to being in part, you know, a sort of a critique of the way, of the sort of neglect of the healthcare sector, and also, as we've discussed a little bit, as being, you know, a critique of a history of scientific racism and, the way that had, sort of, you know, identified and sort of categorized black bodies as being deficient. It was also a critique of the state. So they took up a very kind of early language of what we now call racial health disparities, you know, and they identified the fact that lots of other genetic diseases that affect other groups, diseases like Tay-Sachs and cystic fibrosis, for example, were getting lots of support from the federal government and lots of support from philanthropies, but not sickle cell anemia. And so they rose that sort of, they brought that comparative framework to the fore, and that's become sort of very commonplace in the way that we talk about health inequality, right? The differences in, you know, how people have access to resources, or what, you know, what patients get, what advanced therapies and what patients don't, you know, how patients fare in certain settings, and how some patients fare worse or better in certain settings than others, based often on their kind of their social identities or their social locations. And so the sickle cell anemia campaign really, I think, embodies all of the sort of complicated and sophisticated aspirations that the Black Panther Party brought to their work. So it was very much about the practical work of health education, health awareness, and health outreach, right? But it was also about the political work of bringing awareness to the sort of racial inequality and kind of economic inequality facets of healthcare inequality in American society.
Against the Grain is the program. I'm Sasha Lilly. I'm speaking with Alondra Nelson. She teaches sociology at Columbia University and is the author of Body and Soul, The Black Panther Party and the Fight Against Medical Discrimination, which we're discussing today. Alondra, another campaign that the Black Panther Party was very much involved in, headed up by Huey Newton, was work to protect the poor and incarcerated from being guinea pigs for medical research. In the midst of all of this, in the 70s, the news came to light, published in the New York Times, as you mentioned, of the Tuskegee experiments on black men, the syphilis experiments that lasted for four decades. And the Black Panther Party organized around both this type of work, and they focused on blocking the establishment of a Center for the Study and Reduction of Violence at UCLA. Can you tell us what was at stake in that struggle? What was it about?
Yes, that's a great question. you know, one thing about just to begin about the Tuskegee study is that, you know, the Black Panthers' work around healthcare begins before the revelation of Tuskegee. So, you know, sometimes I'm asked, you know, why did the Black Panthers become health activists? Obviously, they were just responding to, you know, the national travesty of, you know, the revelation of Tuskegee. And, you know, as we've discussed, their health activism started several years prior to the revelation of Tuskegee. And so, you know, one thing I would say is that we need to understand, instead of, you know, Tuskegee creating the context into which the Black Panthers' health activism emerges, it's in fact that the Black Panther Party had been creating a conversation around health inequality, racism, and health and medicine. And that context was what the sort of context into which the Tuskegee controversy emerged, right? So that's a kind of inverse relationship that I think it's, you know, fruitful for thinking about, that the Panthers were in part, you know, one of the groups that were kind of setting the terms of debate in American society around racialized medicine, around racial inequality in science and medicine as Tuskegee was emerging.
Sure.
And part of the way that they were doing this were things like their campaign at at UCLA. And what was at stake was that, you know, there was a kind of slippery slope the Panthers saw well from their own experience in part, that moved from medicalization and from the, you know, racialization of medicine to criminalization, right? Part of what in this violence centered embodied it that was being proposed at UCLA embodied it so very well. And so, you know, typically as we think about medicalization in the social science literature, people seek out medicalization. They want the medical establishment to say, you know, you're sick, and because you're sick, that means you can get, you know, these resources or this sort of help. But for communities, you know, in the context of white supremacy, for communities that are racialized, medicalization didn't mean that. It meant that people were criminalized. And so, on the one hand, the Center for the Research and Research in Reduction of Violence was about sort of making violence into a biological entity, and there were theories that that were being proposed and were going to be tested on, you know, actual patients and through clinical research trials, that, you know, the reason that there was so much violence in American society, so twinned with the kind of crisis, the discourse around the healthcare crisis, was this discourse around and language around violence, the rise of violence in American society. And there were theories by some reputable but obviously we can have skepticism about their credentials, scientists who were suggesting that the reason that there was an increase in violence in American society was because you had people with diseased brains, effectively. And so in this case, you know, it wasn't the case that people were going to, that there was sympathy if this was true, or that people were going to get adequate medical care. You know, the reaction was effectively to use medical care as a form of social control and surveillance, or moreover to institutionalize populations who were unsurprisingly male and significantly Black and Latino men and boys in particular. And so what was at stake actually was, you know, lots of things. What was at stake was the fact that there were populations for whom medicalization did not equal sympathy or therapy, for whom medicalization meant criminalization and institutionalization. And, you know, also what was at stake, and you see this in the Panther literature around the violence center, is the sort of rise of the carceral state, the rise of incarceration in American society, for reasons, you know, based on theories that people can be born criminals, that there can be something about Black and brown bodies that is inherently, criminal, and thus, you know, can justify such, invasive procedures and highly speculative and highly experimental procedures.
The Black Panther Party organized at a time of a shrinking welfare state, which had always unequally served African Americans. Now, looking forward 40 years, that welfare state has been very much rolled back, and there are still enormous health disparities on the basis of race. How would you assess the durability of the legacy of the Black Panthers and their health activism today, given the larger state of affairs to do with race and society and medicine?
It's a bittersweet legacy, because precisely as you suggest, you know, that we have we've lost the battle. I think progressives have lost the battle, and really, you know, insisting that healthcare is a human right. It's part of what has been playing out over the last several decades since the Panthers were doing this work is just, more and more increasingly explicitly is just the sense that some bodies have more value than other bodies, right? And so we see that in the way that the Trayvon Martin case has been dealt with, and we see that in the way that healthcare is meted out or not meted out. There's just, it's just become okay, that in our society to sort of fairly openly, behave in ways that suggest that not all human lives have dignity or value, but that some of them have dignity and value. And so in that regard, you know, the Panther legacy, less successful. I think where it's been more successful, and I've been thinking a lot about this in the context of the Affordable Care Act, is that, you know, they kept their eyes on justice, and they kept their eyes on healthcare as a human right. And I think one of the, one of the sort of poignant and sad things for me about the debates about the Affordable Care Act is that we've allowed them to pivot on the conversation to pivot on these very narrow legal technicalities, instead of, you know, going to the what I call in the book the social health frame of the Black Panther Party that understood health to be absolutely about issues of justice, issues of economic mobility and economic fairness, issues of racial equality and racial justice. And so it's a legacy I think that still matters in that case, and a legacy that I hope that we can grab a hold of as our, you know, healthcare issues increasingly become reduced to, technical issues and also to sort of in clauses and insurance policies and these sorts of things. But I think another, you know, sort of very practical and sort of brick and mortar legacy is the example of the Common Ground Health Clinic in New Orleans, which I think offers, two stories for us. So, there were three people, who started the Common Ground Health Clinic, after Hurricane Katrina and after the failure of the city's infrastructure in New Orleans in 2005. And 2 days after that, these activists, you know, see that there's no healthcare in the city. You'll remember that people die at Charity Hospital. Your listeners will recall that doctors and nurses who are usually not permitted to leave in crisis situations are allowed to leave New Orleans. And so the city is left completely without healthcare. And in this moment, they start this clinic. And one of these people is a gentleman named Malik Rahim, who was a member of the Black Panther Party in New Orleans. And that chapter in particular would face some of the worst police repression. There would be lots of murders of Black Panther parties and members of the party in that chapter. But Rahim, you know, says today that the reason that he, you know, had the faith that they could start a health clinic in the face of the devastation of Katrina, you know, devastation that was both naturally made and human made, of course, through, again, the same sorts of neglect that the Black Panther Party were talking about 40 years prior, was because he had done this as a Black Panther Party. So for Malik Rahim, the model of the People's Free Medical Clinic is a model, a condition of possibility. It's a model that he can work with to imagine in the face of total devastation, total neglect, total mistreatment, that they could start a health clinic in New Orleans. And these today are the Common Ground Health Clinic. So that's one sort of visible and I think positive, story. I think, you know, but one of the legacy, but a more bittersweet aspect of the same legacy is that, you know, in the decades since the Black Panther Party were doing their clinics, social activism, radical activism has been increasingly criminalized. So it's the case that, you know, you now have to, you know, the sit-in marches of the 1950s, the protests of the 1960s. I mean, today to do any of these things, you would have to go to City Hall and get a permit, right? So that, you know, the Occupy protesters are supposed to have a permit from the city to protest. And so, you know, this is the case with, it became the case with clinics too. The clinics, and particularly in cities like Chicago, the Panthers clinics faced resistance from the police, and from public health authorities that wanted to regulate them. And so one would imagine today, if people wanted to replicate the People's Free Medical Clinics, that they would face both resistance in the form of criminalization and resistance in the form of kind of regulatory red tape that was, you know, effectively meant to stop the clinics. So, this is a long way of getting to the point, which is that, you know, what's sad about the Common Ground Clinic example as a legacy of the Panthers' work is that it becomes, you know, it's a bit like Naomi Klein's shock doctrine, right? It's like only when everything collapses can we imagine that the state will allow a grassroots clinic to arise and operate, right? It's only in those conditions, right? You can't imagine that these three people would have been allowed under, you know, normal, quote unquote, normal conditions to start this clinic and the poor, you know, in Algiers or in poor neighborhoods in New Orleans. And so that's a kind of complicated legacy. But I think the legacy that's uncomplicated and that's clear and true is that the Black Panther Party always understood healthcare to be related to all sorts of broader issues of equality and justice.
I'm afraid we're entirely out of time.